Welcome to the fourth episode of The Cleft's Edge. My name is Paul Brooke Weens, and I'm here with my guest today, Neil Wiesenzell. Neil has been the conductor or musical director of multiple professional ensembles, including the Vancouver Philharmonic Orchestra, Vancouver Opera, and Edmonton Opera. He is also one of the most prolific opera composers in Canada, where his eight operas have been performed over 200 times across Canada. In Winnipeg, he is the conductor of Summer Choir, Winnipeg World Village Gospel Choir, and he is an instructor of music at Canadian Mennonite University. Neil, welcome here.
Thanks for having me.
So, to begin, I would like to blast to the past. When did you know that you wanted to be involved in music?
You know, I was taking lessons, piano lessons with Corrine Wilson, and I was at U of M, struggling through a first year science because I wanted to be a doctor. And Corrine was like, you know, you're playing really well. You should audition for the School of Music. And I was like, what? Audition for the School of Music? I just thought that was I didn't think that was me at all. But then I thought, you know, I've been playing piano since I was five. I was 20 at the time. So I auditioned and got in and never looked back.
So where was Corrine Wilson living at the time?
She was living on 99 Rattan Bay.
Wow. I took lessons from Corrine Wilson when I was a child. From 1990 probably to 1994.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
This would have been just before that.
She was on Rattan Bay.
Yeah. That's right.
Unreal. Small. So you were in Winnipeg at the time?
Yeah.
Born and raised in Winnipeg?
Born in Dauphin.
Okay.
Moved here in 75.
Okay. How do you say your last name?
Wiesenzell.
Where's your last name from?
It's German. Das ist ein deutscher Name.
Okay.
My great-grandfather emigrated from Germany.
So, do you say Wiesenzell because that is actually how it's pronounced in German? Or do you say it because it's been pronounced like that ever since you moved here?
It could be Wiesenzell, okay. You could say. Some people that know German will pronounce it like that.
Yes.
So for me, either or.
Very interesting. So you end up going into the School of Music at that point?
Yeah, as a pianist.
Okay. And where does it go from there?
Well, I took lessons and really gravitated towards working with singers. A lot of my friends were singers. I sang in the university singers with Henry Engbrecht and did a lot of playing for singer friends of mine. Most of my friends were singers. So I went to school with Donna Fletcher and Mary LaSherbo and Jim Hickerson and people like that that I've kept in touch with. And there was always a singer who was grabbing me and bringing me into a practice room saying, I have to do this tomorrow for a master class. So I ended up being a really good sight reader, and I didn't really so much like playing the solo repertoire.
Okay.
I really liked collaborating with people. And Leonard Isaacs was still teaching there.
Oh, yes.
He was an amazing resource because he studied with a student of Debussy's. So anytime you had any art song to him, he just had the most amazing insight. So that became one of my specialties, actually. I still love that repertoire to this day, especially Debussy, the art songs. So I did that for a while. For a couple of years, and then I entered the performance stream. So I auditioned for a piano performance. I got into piano performance.
Where?
At U of M.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the third year. So you had to declare a major at the end of the second year. So I thought I'll go for piano performance, even though psychologically I'm not really laid out to be that kind of a performer, as I discovered, because my third year recital was a total disaster, and I just got the mind monkeys got a hold of me, and I just derailed the whole process. So then I took a year and studied performance anxiety and really made some progress on that and came back and did a fabulous third year recital, got a good mark. But then at that point, I got tendonitis. So I had faulty technique, and the teachers there were more concerned with learning repertoire than learning how to play the instrument. So the wheels totally fell off. I couldn't play piano at all. And whenever I played, it felt like I had giant knives being jabbed into my forearms. It was very painful. I could barely pick up a glass of water. My forearms had been shattered from all the bad technique.
So tell me about your mindset at that point. you think you're going to be a performance pianist, mm-hmm. perhaps a collaborative pianist with singers, mm-hmm. because that's what you'd been doing a lot. Mm-hmm. What now?
Yes, exactly. I was like, what am I going to do now? I don't know how to do anything else but play the piano. But I had a Hohner clavinet. You know what a clavinet is?
No.
You know the beginning of Stevie Wonder's Superstition? Yeah. That's a clavinet.
Okay.
It's a very funky keyboard from the 70s. Its a predecessor was an actual clavinet that was the predecessor of the piano. I had one of those that my brother had, and I had an old, I'm dating myself now, I had a reel-to-reel recorder. And this clavinet had different sounds that you could make. So what I did is I really liked Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, so I took the full score of the Nutcracker, and I made my own arrangement, and I played all the different parts on this clavinet and recorded that. And that was a little project, because I guess I felt, now that I look back at it, I guess I felt that I needed to do something musical. Like, I could play a little bit, right? I just couldn't practice or perform. So, and then, yeah, I started to get more interested in studying scores and thinking about how composers put their music together.
Right, so where does your education go from there? Or did you take a break once you had that tendonitis?
What did I do? After university, so I got through my degree.
You
so
did?
I managed to do a jury,
okay.
Not a recital though. I went back to general and I was able to do a jury, and so I was able to graduate. Then I went to France and did a student work abroad program.
Okay.
Where they would give you a work permit and you can go work there. And I worked and taught English for an English language school and lived in Paris and taught English to these French businessmen and businesswomen. I had grown up speaking, well, my mom spoke French and I had taken French through school and at university, and I'd gone to a French immersion project in Quebec one summer for 6 weeks, and I was really starting to get a good hold on French. So by the time I got to France, I was pretty well fluent. So I really enjoyed living in Paris, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. and took some lessons from a teacher at the Paris Conservatory. And I rented a piano and just, you know, went and saw as many art galleries and shops and concerts and stuff like that as I could.
Okay.
And then I got back, and then I was introduced to Michael Kavanagh through our mutual friend Tiffany Wilson. So Michael had this opera script called Gisela and Her Bathtub that he had shopped around to all the legit composers, and nobody was interested. Nobody wanted to touch it. There was no money. It was just on a lark, you want to do this. And so Tiffany said to me, oh, you should meet my friend Mike. He's got this libretto. So we met and I had a look at it, and I said, I'd never written anything before, really, a song, as part of a history project at U of M, but I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. So I wrote this opera that ended up being a huge hit and still performed to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting and kind of came out of left field, because I didn't really know I could do that. But it was so much fun. So I was the music director. That was probably my first conducting gig, because I was the music director,
okay.
for that show.
Okay.
So it was Tiffany and Michael, and Peter Weens was the baritone, and I played piano, and Reed Harrison was playing cello. So we put it on at the Walker after it had been decommissioned as a movie theater, but before it became the Burton Cummings,
mm-hmm.
it was the Walker, and it was just this shell, this beautiful old theater. So we were one of the first. It had just reopened, so we were one of the first things to be in there, the Fringe Festival of 1991.
Wow. So 8 operas now.
Yeah.
How many of them have you conducted?
Every one except this last one, the one about Louis Riel. So that one that was just done in March in Regina, that was Gord Girard that conducted that. But
very
every
good.
One of them I've conducted. So that's basically, that's how I learned the craft. And singing in Henry Imbert's choir. That's how I learned from him what works. And then I also studied conducting the second time I was in France in the 90, in the 94. I lived in the south of France in Toulon, and I studied conducting at a conservatory there, a national conservatory. Toulon was about 60 kilometers east of Marseille on the coast there. Really nice little town. So I studied conducting at the conservatory as well as piano. And then I got to know the fellow who ran the opera company. Christian Segarici was his name. And he was the conductor at Opéra de Toulon. And I lived like literally two blocks away from there. So wow. he coached me. I was, at that point, I had written Gisela and Her Bathtub and City Workers in Love. And I had just written The Bachelor Farmers of the Apocalypse. And I was coming back to Winnipeg to conduct it. And it was a very complicated score that I had created. And I didn't necessarily know how to conduct it. So I brought it to him, to Mr. Segarici. And he helped me figure out the best way to conduct that. And so that was really helpful training. And I could go to all the rehearsals and stuff. This little opera company in this little town did 10 productions a year.
Wow.
Yeah. It was so rich. And they had their opera house was, you know, the old Paris Opera was designed by Charles Garnier. This was also designed by Charles Garnier, but it was 2/3 the size. Mm-hmm. So it was like a mini Paris Opera House. But an acoustical marvel with like 5 balconies, maybe 30 rows, just like an opera house should be, with a really tall and not very deep, right? So that was really lucky to be able to get some study in there and go see all these operas. And
was that experience before or after your master's?
Before. Yeah.
So when did you decide to, quote unquote, come home to do a master's?
Well, I thought, so then I started thinking, well, you know, I relearned how to play the piano with Sidney McGuinness. I got over my tendonitis. Ironically, I only learned how to play the piano after I graduated.
Okay.
But I did learn, tendonitis went away. I didn't have any problems after that. Never have. Thank you, Sidney McGuinness. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, God, there's so many pianists around, and so many pianists are so good. I don't know if I want to compete in that market, but hey, this composing thing, I seem to be able to do that. It seems like I have a talent or a gift.
Right. So had you already done that opera with Michael Cavanaugh by the time you went and did your master's?
Yes. I've written Gisela, City Workers, and The Bachelor Farmers of the Apocalypse.
Very good.
And I thought, maybe I should actually get some training.
So you go where for your master's?
I went to UBC in Vancouver.
Okay.
So I moved there in 96. And I took a year and a half. Actually, I got a job as the music director of the Young Artists Ensemble at Vancouver Opera.
Oh, wow.
So I put back my, started my master's for 6 months because it was, we were doing Cenerentola and Mike Cavanaugh was directing. So I did that for the first six, well, for like the fall.
What was the name of the program?
It was before the Yolanda Ferris.
Yes.
This was in 96, but it was called basically our Young Artist Program.
Because they just did Cenerentola.
Yes.
Anyways,
I know everything full comes circle. Around. Yeah. Yeah, full circle. Well, that was 1996.
Okay.
So I did 2 years at UBC, did my master's in composition.
Mm-hmm. And ended up staying there.
Ended up staying there, yeah.
For
16 years.
16 years. And what did you do while you were there?
Everything. I did, I worked as a church musician at a couple of different churches. I worked on a couple of films as a composer. I scored a couple of things for Bravo and Sportsnet documentaries, that kind of stuff. Wrote a piece for the Vancouver Intercultural Orchestra. Did a lot of arranging and playing and got involved with some work in the downtown east side with a theater company called Vancouver Moving Theater. I did a ton of stuff there, and some of them, and you know, I was conducting the Vancouver Philharmonic Orchestra. Every November we did a big concert at the church I was working at, which had a big tie to Remembrance Day, so we did all the big requiems, or is it requia, Verdi, Mozart, Durufley, all the big requiems with orchestra.
And you
I
did. Were conducting.
I was conducting all those. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I had, because I had, the church basically gave me free rein, so I just programmed all this stuff, and I knew I had an in with the orchestra, and I could get a few choirs together. And so that was really fun. Right. Yeah. And great opportunity.
So you brought that here in a different, well, maybe a similar format, but Summer Kerr,
yeah. I had a friend, Daryl Nixon, who's a friend of my wife's, Rachel, and he worked at St. Andrew's Wesley Church, one of the big United Churches downtown. Mm-hmm. And he would did this summer choir thing. And he was an organist, fantastic, virtuosic organist. And he had this giant instrument in this big church. So he and his wife would do this thing in the summer. She would conduct and he would play, and they did all the masterworks. I thought, that's cool. There mm-hmm. isn't something like that in Winnipeg. There's so many great singers in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. but there's not a lot going on this summer. So maybe there's an opportunity there to do something where I get people together just once a week. And, you know, people come and go, and that's totally fine. People go on holidays and they come back. But my thing was I wanted to do with orchestra because I'm really interested in working with orchestra, both as a conductor and as a composer. Because mm-hmm. studying orchestral scores, I should be studying orchestral scores as a composer. I don't often have time. So when I do summer corps, I'm obligated to study the score and pick up, you know, whatever material I can from all these great masterworks. And so this is the third year we've been doing it.
Okay. And what brought you back to Winnipeg? How many years ago, you said?
We moved back in 2012. Kind of fell out of love with Vancouver. Housing prices, of course, were going through the roof. Traffic was just bonkers. And I don't know, the art scene there, it's hard, very hard. And just people seem stressed. They're so stressed. Everybody's in so deep trying to just work and pay their mortgage. Mm-hmm. And the gas prices are just like, it's beautiful. But there's a lot of things that we didn't really like about it, my wife Rachel and I. My parents were still living here, getting older, and okay. I thought, you know, I want to spend some time with them. And our daughter was 6 at the time, wanted her to know her grandparents more. So we just moved. And I didn't really have anything on the ground here.
Okay.
Nothing.
Wow.
But I still had a bunch of gigs in Vancouver. So it was still cheaper to live here and fly back to Vancouver to do these gigs. So
what?
I did that for a couple of years. Yeah.
That is expensive.
It was. So I did that, and then I started World Village Gospel Choir in 2012. So that was the one thing I thought, well, I better have something. So that's when I decided to start that choir.
And of course, you've built up multiple different opportunities for yourself and others in the community now. Why don't you jump into some of the other things that you do, like your instructor at CMU.
Oh, yeah.
You have the World Village Gospel Choir. Well, feel free to start where you want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I had a friend in Vancouver who had the choir, a gospel choir, that met once a month because it was on Vancouver Island and he lived in Vancouver. So, and the thing was, they would pick the repertoire, they would get together and rehearse on one big long Saturday for like 4 hours. Then he would make practice tracks to send to them. And the singers would work on the practice track and memorize the practice track. Then next month they get together, work on the next couple songs, finesse the stuff that they had already memorized. And I thought, that's really cool. Like, everybody's, you know, we know there's so many choirs in Winnipeg. I didn't want to plug up somebody's weekday, because there's a community choir, there's church choir. When you do something on a Saturday, once a month, people can still participate in their church choir, their community choir. Mm-hmm. And also, we don't use a score. So we teach the music by rote.
Wow.
So also, there was a big, I thought, and I might be wrong, but I don't think there's a lot of choirs in Winnipeg you can sing in if you can't read music. So I knew that there was a lot of people out there that would love to sing but don't read music. So this was the choir for them. And it also challenged me as a conductor in a different way. So my score studying was not, how do the notes go on the page? But it's like, I had to memorize all the parts. Memorize the soprano part. Memorize the alto part. Memorize the tenor part. Memorize the bass part and be able to teach it. So that was really interesting.
So when you have a concert, how long is the program?
There's, we usually do 7 to 8 songs.
Okay.
That's usually, we found that's about all that a group of singers can keep in their head for one afternoon, because that's a lot.
And do you do one concert a year?
We do a spring concert and a fall concert.
That's amazing. That's an amazing amount of repertoire to cover in one rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to learn all the parts.
Mm-hmm. And often the music is unpublished. It's something that I've seen on YouTube, or somebody sends me a little scrap of a song that they know or that I thought was cool, that I then arrange. for the choir, and then from there I teach it, and then Rachel and I and some other singers make the practice tracks and send those out.
Very good.
So in the course of doing all that, I kind of the music gets into my head by osmosis.
And then how do you go about finding the singers for the choir?
Just word of mouth, advertising. Actually, I was singing in the... We were living in Fort Garry, and I was singing in the church choir at Fort Garry United Church with Helen. And she was really lovely. She let me do a little workshop on gospel and world music in her choir rehearsal, which was great. And then I said... This was like spring of 2012. We were here visiting, and I basically said, I'm starting a gospel choir. Who's in? And, you know, 10 people put up their hands. I said, okay, here we go. And so we started at Augustine Church. That's where the village in the name comes from. World Village Gospel Choir.
Okay.
So also, we had had a lot of support with our daughter Mirko when we were in Vancouver, and the old adage, it takes a village to raise a child. It was kind of that too. And then World, because we don't do just gospel, we do world music. Mm-hmm. So we do music from all different kinds of faith traditions and cultures. We've done stuff in Zulu and we're doing something in Kurundi, which is the language of Burundi, at our next concert. We've done stuff in Arabic. We've done stuff in Hebrew. We've even done stuff in Icelandic. We've done a bunch of different languages. And that's really fun for people to... it really expands everybody's mindset when you sing something in another language.
No kidding.
And in that way, the practice tracks are really helpful because we know how relatively poor in information a written score is, right? It gives you duration, pitch, and what the word is.
Dynamic, maybe.
Yeah, yep. But that's about it. But the amount of information that you can give somebody when you sing something to them is, there's so much more there. So that's been really fun to find music. It's a challenge finding music because we usually do stuff, like I say, that hasn't been published, and I arrange it myself. But it's a really fun and enlightening experience.
And you said you have a spring concert typically?
Yeah.
And is that one coming up?
Coming up, yeah. May 11th.
May 11th, week away.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. You and your wife are also cross-involved in a number of projects?
Yes, well, we do. I mean, Rachel's has her own music that she writes and performs, and she's an outstanding vocal soloist and creator, has written some beautiful, beautiful music. She's learning how to play the harp. We got ourselves a little harp last summer as well, and she plays piano very well also. And we met originally as friends in Vancouver.
Okay.
She came to see a concert that I was... doing at the church I was working at, and then we just end up doing a bunch of gigs together just as friends, and she has the ability to really affect the people in the audience. And we were doing a gig one time at our church, and somebody was there who was preparing a fundraiser for Bill Clinton, who was coming to Vancouver. This was 2008, I think.
Okay.
And so he hired Rachel to come sing at this fundraiser. Wow. So we ended up co-writing a song for this piece, and it was a big, big, big deal. Very kind of a little bit terrifying, but mostly fun at this giant mansion in Vancouver, and performed for Bill Clinton when he was there. And it was very exciting and fun. And so we co-wrote this song, but she's got a whole CD of her own original material, and she also writes lyrics. She's very different than me. She writes her own lyrics.
Okay.
Whereas I don't really do that.
In 2010, if I'm right, did you not play something at the Olympics?
Yes. Yeah, we did. Well, the Olympics were in Vancouver that year.
Yes.
And so they had, in the old industrial land on the south side of False Creek, they had just started to rent to develop that. So they had an old salt factory that had been changed into, it was the athlete's living room. So they had a juice bar, they had pool, they had foosball, they had ping pong, they had all these places for the athletes to unwind. And they also had this thing called a glass piano, which they had brought in from China. It was a transparent piano. It was made out of plexiglass.
Okay.
So I got that gig, and they said, you have to play music for 18 to 24-year-olds. So I had to look to see what they were listening to. So back in the time, it was like Lady Gaga and Black Eyed Peas and that kind of stuff. So I bought all these books and I learned all this music to play on the piano. And Rachel came one time and we sang for them. And they were, you know, they were just kind of chilling out doing their thing. And it was a very kind of informal atmosphere, but it was really fun to be part of the whole thing. Because, I mean, just the amount of people involved to put something like that on was just mind-boggling.
Those are two very special instances of what can happen when you're a musician.
That's right.
Play at the Olympics.
That's right.
Get to do something with Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So I want to drill down a bit more into the conducting.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about conducting that you enjoy a lot? And what is it about conducting that you could leave at the rehearsal, I guess is a good way to put it. I don't want to do this anymore, but you have to because you're the conductor.
Yeah. I like being in control. That's why I like to be the conductor. I learned how to conduct by conducting my own music, so I knew exactly what I wanted. When I heard it, I knew exactly what I wanted. Maybe I didn't know right off the bat because I was just getting started, but... Plus, I could never, there was no money, so I could never find anybody to do it as cheaply as I would do it, right? And so that's the part I like. Sometimes, but there's a part of me that likes this too, managing large groups of people. Like, when we're doing a summer choral concert, there's like 60 in the orchestra and 90 in the choir. Like, it's a lot of people to manage. And most of the time, I like that, but sometimes it just gets to be too much. So that's, and all organizing. I mean, when you're, this is all DIY, right? I don't, World Village Gospel Choir, Summer Choir is just me and assistant conductor. World Village Gospel Choir is me and Rachel. We don't have a board of directors. Mm-hmm. We have a choir manager now who's helping us out, Sarah Neufeld has been really great with the gospel choir. So she's been able to pick up some of the administrative slack. That sometimes Rachel and I just was falling through the cracks. And so that kind of stuff, I just want to make music. And so I'm willing to put in the time to do that kind of stuff. Like, I produced a lot of my own operas back in the day and fringe festivals all across the country. And I know how to produce. Like, I don't love it, but I'll do it just because I know it has to be done. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I'm too cheap to hire anybody else to do it, so I figure I'll just do it myself.
Well, you will only get paid a certain amount for doing this work.
Yes.
And so your choice is, do I do the work or do I try to get a contracted out, get someone else to do it, and then you don't get paid as much.
Yeah.
The life of a musician.
Yeah.
How have you found that as a conductor, a composer, pianist? The life of a musician can be fruitful in that it gives back to you and your soul, and it gives to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But from a monetary sense, it can be feast or famine at times.
Mm-hmm.
You've been through it for 20 years?
At least
20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably had your own share of struggles and your own share of platitudes.
Mm-hmm.
What have you found gets you through the toughest times, especially financially?
Mm-hmm.
To say, I am going to continue on regardless of what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, you know, when a lot of times people say when they're coming to sing in the gospel choir or in some choir, they just say, you know, I was in a really bad mood when I got here. And after I sang for a couple hours, I just felt so great. That is the kind of stuff that makes my day. So then I think, okay, all the work I've done to make, it's kind of like making a sandbox. I'm making a sandbox and I'm saying to people, come and play in here with me, right? And I'm, you know, I have some parameters and things that need to be done in order to, for us to all play together well, but it's pretty loose and pretty mostly based on fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that part is really worth a lot. And the monetary thing is just like, you know, if I'm not making a lot of money, I don't spend a lot of money. Like, I can be very frugal when I need to be. And, you know, I don't grab a fancy car and I don't have fancy clothes and I don't pay a lot of money for haircuts, so.
For those of you who can't see him, he is bald like me.
So I never really thought too much about that part of it. More just was trying to, what happened is when I really decide to focus on composing, instead of trying to do everything that I could do, but didn't necessarily something I should be doing. When I started to focus on composing, I found that stuff just flowed my way. That was very interesting.
And you like to be in control, you said. So as a composer, I'm sure it's not just operatic composition. You must have done some choral works, etc. That makes sense to me that you would be the first or one of the ones to conduct that work because you know how you see it in your head. Is that the kind of control you like? How difficult is it for you to watch someone else conduct your work?
I thought it was going to be hard to watch somebody else conduct my work, but I have to trust them. And if I trust them, then I don't have to go through the painful process of the first rehearsal, which is the worst. As a composer, if there are any composers out there listening, try not to go to the first rehearsal. Let the conductor do his job and just put the mechanics of the piece together, because sometimes it can sound like it's not going to work if, depending on the ensemble and how much time people have had to prepare, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, I gave Policoro my piece of Benedictus, right? And I trusted John, and I knew that he would do a good job. I didn't ask to come to any rehearsals, and he said I was welcome, but I was like, you know what? I was confident enough that I had said everything I need to say on the page.
Yeah.
And everything after that was just expression. And it sounded beautiful. Policoro did a great job. And then Janet Brenneman took the same piece at CMU and did her own thing with it. And it was the same piece, but so completely different in so many ways.
That's awesome.
It is awesome.
It's the same piece, but a different language is being spoken every time it's sung.
So that to me was fascinating. It's like, oh, I never would have thought to do that. So when people can find music in the, like, all I'm writing is rhythms and pitches to text. That's all it is. There's so many ways that you can, as a conductor, you can interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to conduct it, I would probably conduct it again a completely different way.
Absolutely.
So that's a really great thing about, you know, trusting people is, At the beginning, back to your question, was how hard is it to see other people conduct my work? The first time, it was pretty stressful, and I wasn't enjoying it. But then I actually realized that it could be relaxing. I just had to change my attitude and just say, this is, you know, I've done my work. It's your piece now. Make it your own. Own it. I don't really care what you do with it as long as you own it and make it real. And then, you know, that's the great thing about the times we live in. My music doesn't really have a performance practice per se. So there's lots of leeway there.
Interesting. You're, from a conducting point of view, you got a chance to watch Henry Engbrecht because you were in his choirs. Was there anyone else that had a great influence on you from a conducting standpoint?
Diane Loomer, when I was at UBC, she founded Corleone and Elektra.
Of course.
So when I was at UBC, she was conducting the mass choir.
Okay.
And there was a rehearsal she couldn't take, so she asked me to fill in for her. And so I had a couple lessons with her, which was great. And then she also asked me, one of the choirs were doing some contemporary music, so she asked me for some input on contemporary music. So that was kind of fun. I felt like she regarded me as a colleague. And I really got some great information from her. Bramwell Tovey was also a guy who was very helpful back in, God, I don't even know, remember when this was, when he was working here, Winnipeg Symphony, his first couple years. And he got hired by Manitoba Opera to conduct Dialogues of the Carmelites. So, and just so happened, my writing partner, Mike Cavanaugh, was the production manager at that time. So I said to Mike, hey, do you think Bramwell would like somebody to like sharpen his pencils and get him coffee and like an assistant? And I could just kind of, you know, be a fly on the wall and watch him work. And Mike said, well, I'll ask him. So he emailed Bramwell, who was in England at the time, said, you know, I have somebody who could be would you like to have an assistant? And he said, yes, for sure. So I said, great, okay. So then the first rehearsal came, and there were big league singers. Luckily, I didn't really know who these people were, but Judith Forrest, Jean Stilwell, Joanne Kolomayach, these were the singers that were in the show. And I was like 22 or 23 or something. So we're at the first rehearsal, and Kelly Robinson was directing. So, and the call sheet gets passed around, and am I, instead of assistant to the conductor, beside my name it says assistant conductor, and I'm like, uh-oh. And then, so the director is saying, okay, you know, this and that, this is like, welcome everybody, blah, blah, blah. And so Bramwell wasn't able to make his flight yesterday, so Neil, you'll be conducting today. Next order of business, and I'm sitting there going, uh-oh. Tad Bernacki was the pianist, and he was very gracious, and he just said, you know, it won't be a problem, just do your thing. So I don't remember anything about that day, but I did all rehearsals for the first day. And then Bramwell flew into town, and then he would just, I would watch him work, and then he would say, oh, why don't you conduct this scene? So he would let me conduct the scene.
Oh, wow.
Which was great. And then there was one day, because Tad also worked at the Royal Winnipeg Ballet, Tad, who was the pianist, so he wasn't going to be there on Thursday. So Bramwell said, why don't you take rehearsals Thursday, and I'll play the piano. I said, okay. And it was an upright piano, so Bramwell was behind the piano just playing. None of the singers could see him. And so they were following me. And so we would do our thing. And then Kelly would go talk to the singer. So Bramwell would come over. Okay, there, you know, you should have your stick up. And maybe over here you might want to do this move. And he was giving these mini lessons, which was great. And then he said, okay, for the dress rehearsal, I want you to conduct the last scene. You know, the last scene where they're all going to the guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Big, big climax of the opera. Very easy to conduct. It's all in 4-4. There's nothing tricky there. But he said, I want to go to the back of the hall and hear how the bounce is. So you take this part for the dress rehearsal. So I was like, immediately grabbed the, you know, got a copy of the full score. This score was just, the score for this thing was just gigantic. So I got a copy of this and I was studying it so hard. And when it came time to the dress rehearsal, though, they had never actually run through that piece. Even in the Zizpro, they hadn't gotten to it. So Bramwell said, you know, we've never done it, so I'm just going to take it. So I was at the same time relieved and disappointed.
Of course.
But he really gave me some wonderful opportunities there. And I learned a lot, really learned a lot from him. And also just the way he listens, he took it up a level. The way he listened, like he would listen to these high-end opera singers, and just little comments here and there. He never said the word sharp or flat, but he talked about a color of a vowel. Well, it might be a little bit dark, or it might be a little bit bright, because these caliber of singers, they're not singing flat or sharp. It's just, it's another level above that. And so I found that I was able to pick stuff out, and I would go, oh, I heard that. I wonder if you're going to say anything. And sure enough, he would talk to the singer about something that I had also noticed, and he taught me how to raise my hearing to a really high level. So that was really interesting, as well as like the mechanics of conducting aren't actually that hard, but the listening. You have a huge score in front of you. You have an entire orchestra, a bunch of singers. Like, how are you?
The vertical listening.
Yeah, the right? Vertical listening. How are you tracking what's going on in the score compared to what you're hearing? That is 90% of the work. I would say the gestures are 10%. The gestures are totally learned. You can learn that in a school. You can learn that with some training. But troubleshooting a bunch of music coming your way, that is the difficulty.
I find that fascinating. One of the reasons I think I could never be a conductor is the vertical listening is, like you said, I think as well, 90% of the role. Where is someone off? How do I get them back on? Well, I'm still listening to everyone else. And some conductors can do it. And I find that absolutely amazing that they can, in performance even, be listening, some person's off, conduct them first, get them back in. Another person's off, conduct them. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As we wrap this up, I always ask this question. Two questions, actually. If it was up to you, and I think I know your answer already. Would you rather conduct a choir of 64 singers, a choir of 16 singers, or a choir of 8 singers?
I would say it depends who the singers are.
Of course. That's a cop-out.
I
Same caliber of singers.
Yeah. I like the big. I would go for the big. I'd go for the big sound.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's because of your background, learning from orchestral conductors at times, operatic works, or just because you enjoy that music more?
I don't know. Like, I enjoy the big sounds, and I was conducting a small group of singers. We were doing some Purcell and stuff, and I don't know, I didn't like that so much. I didn't like I don't even know what it was, really. But there was just something about, maybe it was the repertoire. I didn't really enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I find I get more energy from a large group of singers.
Okay. Good.
Is that a non-cop-out answer?
That's a non-cop-out answer.
Okay, great.
And finally, what is your favorite choral work of all time?
My favorite choral work of all time.
Either to listen to or to conduct.
You know, when Amadeus came out, I bought a CD, a cassette of the Mozart Requiem, and I listened to it every day for a year. So, and when I had my first orchestral conducting gig, it was that piece. So that's pretty high up there. But another piece that I have to say is, and it's not very well known, it's the Requiem of Durufle.
Okay.
Have you ever heard it? Marcel Durufle was a French composer. He only produced in total maybe 25 pieces, but they're all so exquisite. He has a very beautiful Ubi Caritas. That's probably his most famous piece. But his Requiem, I did it in Vancouver with a big orchestra and big choir. It's very very beautiful, very French, and based on Gregorian chant. It's really underrated. It's very tricky, but it's a really, really beautiful piece. So I think, as much as I love the Mozart Requiem, I think I would vote for the Durufle.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Neil. Weisenzel, or Weisenzel, depending who you are. I've really appreciated the time today, and I think that this gave people a very good flavor of who you are, why conducting matters to you, and really why you like to do it. And thank you so much for being in Winnipeg.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.